Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO and founder of Finstrat Management. With me today, I've got Martin Van Kroonenberg. Martin is the founder of BW Ventures, also happens to be in the Netherlands. Martin, how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing very good. And thanks for having me in the show. It's a bit late here, but hey, that's perfect to be in a show, right? And have a good conversation about innovation and investing, etc.
It is. I'm glad Adam Chen introduced us now a couple months back, and really excited to unpack BW Ventures, the fund, and your experience. So let's start with BW. I'm all ears. What's the firm's focus?
So we basically help people that are in innovation in getting their innovation to market. And that starts from a super, super early stage. We once started with what we call a pre-acceleration program. And basically what a pre-acceleration program does is helping you find the value proposition that is worth pitching into markets before you start accelerating anything, or if you're doing it very, very good, before even writing a line of code or creating any type of first prototype. Because we're firm believers in the fact that you should first close deals before you start developing your solution. So that's one of the things. And the second thing is we help a lot with go-to-market, which basically means we start doing cold calls, cold emailing, cold LinkedIn, helping you set up your network sales and partner channels to make sure that you do not only find a value proposition that's worth investing in, but also help them get to the initial sales and traction and make a system out of it.
Wow. What was the inception? What inspired you to go down this road?
Good question. I had my first company when I was 19 years old, and I started in the music industry, which is, it seems like something completely different. But in all honesty, this was in a time where Spotify was popping up. It was accelerating rapidly. So we're talking about 14, 15 years ago. And I ran record labels, a bookings agency, and an event industry. But the thing is, everything was being pushed via iTunes and the music blogs, but Spotify completely changed the whole music industry, not just how you listen to music, but also the interaction with fans and how you got people into events, etc. So back then, I really needed to change my value proposition quickly. Because everything that I wrote out in plans or whatsoever, it was completely different a week later. So I needed to figure out a model in which I could place small bets, basically, and with these small bets, try to figure out what worked in the market at that time. So we experimented really early with, for example, subscription models on artists or on a blog or whatever. And it's interesting because right now you see all these models everywhere. But that's what basically got me into how we think and program basically the early stages of innovation. And my external thesis assessor, because I was still studying back then, he mentioned to me, hey, what you're doing in the music industry is very cool, but I think what you put on paper is something that you should start focusing on, because you can create tremendous value with just that mindset and you know, all the theory that you put out there. And that's basically the inception.
So I heard the word experiment. I was thinking iterate. So yep. What were those first few weeks, months like as you started to experiment?
Yeah, that was very interesting. When we started with BW Ventures, we We basically had two assumptions: either go into corporate innovation or start startup programs. And the funny thing was, we tried to go where we could actually find the first committed customers and or investors. So in this case, we had early conversations with one of the big four companies that were trying to set up a corporate innovation branch in Europe. That was one part of the traction, but it took too long. They were very slow in basically signing the contract. The contract was already there, but they were very slow in signing the contract. The other route was going to investors, let a investor commit to us, and based on that, start running the startup programs. And well, the investor was super, super quick with committing, which gave us basically our first route. And that's where it all started. And then later on, I started going back into corporate innovation, but that's something for later.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, just listening, I mean, the irony of it is the investor basically told you where to focus.
Yeah, it's quite funny. If I teach people something right now, I teach them completely the opposite, to be very honest. I don't teach them, listen to the investor immediately to, you know, let them decide where you should go. Your customer should decide where you should be and where you should go. But in this case, it was both of them was part of the traction assumptions that we had, because my partner back then already worked in an incubator and accelerator. So we already knew, and we already had quite some conversations with founders on what we should create as an initial program, basically.
And so now you're 9 years in. And so yep. what were the initial premise when you got started back in 2016, and how has that evolved?
Well, you know that entrepreneurship is a roller coaster and everything changes all the time. So the initial premise was that we were building basically a basket of smaller stakes in startups, with especially the promise, if you start your company with us, we will help you find the initial customers, your launching customers, and based on that, you can find other investors and build your company. And in the first program, that worked. The ones that we helped in the first program, they're still there. And we already had an exit. We also have one that is still compounding their value. So the initial assumptions were good, but then we were still with the two of us. And we made a assumption that we never tested. And that was, you know, in retrospect, it was a very, very bad decision, because we knew it was an assumption. We knew that we should test every assumption, but we didn't test this assumption. What did we do? We bought a digital agency, basically an agency that could help you with marketing and help you develop your initial SaaS product. It was an acquisition of a company with the assumption that these startups would actually buy our services to develop the first version of that product or to help them with marketing. With the whole introduction, you already get a sort of gist how this all panned out, but it was not a good decision. So we went from 2 people to 20 people. Basically within 2 or 3 years, I needed to liquidate the company. And it also, the other result was splitting up with my then co-founder. You know, different visions, different ways of handling what we were trying to do. And that got me to a point that I needed to revalidate our own model, because now when we initially started, the cash flows were coming from the investor, but you didn't have a business model that was immediately giving you cash. And over the course of my whole entrepreneurial journey, More and more, I'm a very firm believer that cash is king. No matter what you do, cash is really king, and cash flow is the thing that you should manage, no matter what's happening. So, with that in mind, I got a, I got one chance from my investor to reinvent our own model. And he mentioned, I'm going to give you 6 months. If you haven't found any paying customer, then you know it's just over. That's it. And I had one condition to that. All the old stuff that we still had, like the company, etc., you're going to help me liquidate the company or you know sell it, but that's up to you. I'm going to find the new model. And I got it, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be here anymore. But what we figured out is that basically there's three target groups that are in need of our services, meaning they do not know well enough how to run experiments and iterations to get to a value proposition that is worth investing in. So one target group are corporate innovation teams. They know how to generate IDs, they know how to scale them, but it's pretty hard to figure out a value proposition that people are willing to pay for before you have the actual product. So that's one. The second one is VCs and private equity. And they're radically different, but the initial question is basically the same. If I need to create new markets, or I want to enter new markets, or I want to create new product market combinations, the initial question is exactly the same thing. And then you've got the founders that either want to expand their business with new product market combinations, or they're going to start with something. They know that they're going to take quite some risk. How can you, you know, the question is still the same. So that's the model that we found. Literally within 6 months, I found paying customers for all the three target groups. And that really launched us into where we are right now.
When you bought the agency,
mm-hmm.
you think you didn't test?
Mm-hmm. The actual assumption of people willing to buy digital services from the same provider that helped you validate a business case. And that was a interesting thing, because I think they wanted to buy digital services or development, but there was a sort of glitch in between you helping them with validating their business case and validating their value proposition, and then going into, hey, here's the marketing plan. And it's funny because we're now, I think, 6 years later, we do offer go-to-market services right now, but it's radically different. Because then it's not about marketing, it's still about getting your value proposition sold. And it seems like something small, but the promise is we're going to help you expand from the 3 to 4 signed letters of intent at the end of a pre-acceleration program, a validation program, and expanding to your first 10, first 100 paying customers, and systemizing that. And that is something radically different than selling digital marketing services to a startup.
Yeah, I understand. So, you know, so said another way, you know, the core of any marketing strategy is you need to help your buyers understand the return or value yep. that your service or product creates. And absent that, it's just flashy, glossy. Mm-hmm. It may sound and look good, but inconsequential. You know, will your dollars you're asking your buyer to spend create more?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I got it right, it was just the approach that you now found yourself taking.
Yes, but I think you're missing one pretty crucial point. So I think what you're telling is 5% of the actual decision. And 95% is the emotion that you need to tap into, the emotional mind. And yes, especially in B2B, I really think that the business case of your services is one of the major decision points. But how you present that business case, how you deliver on that business case, what problem you're actually solving is something most often different than the actual business case. If you truly understand how to move someone emotionally from the point that they are to where they should be, and you can convert that into a sales pitch or a value proposition pitch, that's where you really, really gain a lot of traction and a lot of conversions.
What example can you give us to help connect the dots for the audience?
So what's funny is what I always tell the people that work with me. In corporate innovation, we're not always there to just find the best business case. One, we're there to help the people in innovation shine for their board and sometimes also get promotions. That's a hidden benefit. And it's funny because with most corporates, this actually happens in reality. They get promotions and they get higher positions within the company. This is quite emotional, and it's not something that you immediately put out on paper, right? You do not put that in an offer. But we know it is a hidden benefit of working with us. Then the second thing is, we are basically the ones that help you do the stuff you do not want to do. So calling people just to ask them questions about what is problems that you're facing or potential solutions that you're looking at. We know that a lot of people see this as one of the biggest hurdles to take, just picking up the phone and start calling random people to have this conversation. But because we're there, people are actually doing it. And that brings them the results that they actually need. And also that it's an emotional blockade that we know how to, pull away and make sure that you actually make the results, which is the business case. But to get there, you need to, tackle all these emotional hurdles. And I think these are two good examples that demonstrate that.
So what I heard is you have to have the wherewithal to listen and engage. At the same time, there's an art in here to getting emotional buy-in.
Yep.
I assume that's a function of the questions you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
And asking them to validate. And I also presume it, I would think maybe there's variations on theme depending if you're talking to a corporate innovation group, an investor, or a founder.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the question. The way you tap into these emotions are different,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that still 95% of the decision is made emotionally is still the same. However, how to approach the founder compared to how to approach the investor. Yeah, that's completely different because I have to tap into different emotions, right? I do not, with an investor, I don't have to tap into the emotion of you as a founder still being there in like a year. I mean, that it doesn't make sense. But that's where, if you do really, really proper market research, that's where the difference is between good market research, which tells you the business case, and outstanding market research, because there is where you can get the very unique value propositions that do make a difference in the emotional part for that specific target group.
So this far in, what have you learned with these three groups that you were really surprised to find out? And challenge how you originally thought about them when you got started.
If I'm talking about Let's first start with corporate innovation. I think what's interesting to me is that when I started out, I thought that every corporate would just need to do innovation and make sure that you survive, basically, because it helps you to create your new motions, right? What I start to see is that innovation is basically an extra account management contact point, if done properly. And it could help you, but there's a very thin line here, but it could help you create more interactions with your current client base and upgrade them, and based on that, go into adjacent markets. And that's a radically different take on what innovation could actually do for your company. And that is not just, hey, there's an AI bubble, what can we do with AI and then implement it in the company? That for me, that's not innovation. Then looking at the investors, and there's a very big gap to what I think founders see in investors. I think investors are very willing to help. There's a lot of capital available if you have the proper value proposition with a proper built case around it. And if you can really tell what kind of impact you will make in a certain market or in a niche, investors are really willing to help you. And I think that has also changed quite a lot in my perspective on the investor world, basically. Because if you're just starting, it all feels like, hey, they want to pick a part of your company and they want to say a lot to what you're going to do with your company. And in all honesty, I don't think investors really want to be that involved in your company. And they shouldn't, because they've portfolios to run, not a company. And from a founder perspective, I mentioned it in the beginning already. Cash is king. And that's what you need to manage. All the rest will come.
Agree 100% that sales and cash, solve a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Think Michael Dell said, I don't know if it was Michael, but someone said something to the effect of sales solves a lot of problems. And it's true. And I agree with your assessment too on the investor front. Obviously, at least in the US, there's thousands of different venture capital and private equity firms. And private equity, depending on what their strategy is, a bit more unique. They'll take over a company and install their own management and process and structure, and that's fine. I mean, that's part and parcel of the asset class. But venture is different. Venture is minority, but you also have a lot of VCs are looking to differentiate themselves in the market by the degree that they're going to be hands-on. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know whether there's a necessarily a right or wrong answer. And the only reason I say that is, yeah, there's, part of company building, I think, is art and what you do today. Part of it's science, what we do today, building an accounting and finance function within a company. Yeah, I mean, there's an element to entrepreneurship that the founder embodies that the investor invests in, because they want to capitalize on their vision and hopefully hustle.
Exactly. And especially that, the hustle.
So I'm curious, your focus, do you find that it's predominantly in the EU? How often do you work outside the Eurozone?
Well, most of the focus is in the EU, but we've also worked for a Japanese company, American company. So it kind of depends on what the actual question is. So geography is not a limiting thing for us. We do want to understand what you're trying to do. We're more focused on B2B than B2C. We have done some B2C in the past, but I just learned over the years that B2B is more of our thing than B2C.
And what role is, so it's interesting you say Japan, when I think about unique cultures, what role does culture play in the work that you do?
From the validation perspective, it's not a role, because if you do your market research and your validation proper, you learn about the different aspects of the culture during the validation process itself. So if you know what questions to ask during your validation phase, you also learn the specifics for that market and thus culture. From a sales perspective, so once you start going into the go-to-market phase, and especially your outbound sales, I think culture makes a difference. Because some countries do want to talk in their own language, for example, or they want to be approached in their own language. How you handle a sales conversation is different. Especially if you're talking to a Japanese company, for example, compared to an American company, but also to a Dutch company. Especially Dutch are also kind of weird, right? In how they handle business, we're super direct. But in both situations, both US and Japanese, you do not do that. So there it makes a difference. But in your validation programs, it shouldn't, because otherwise you're not running the proper validation tests.
And I'm curious, this is going to be a bit in the weeds, but it's kind of fascinating. You've heard the expression, you know, don't boil the ocean. But I would think that you could be working with innovation groups who are looking to sell not only domestically, but internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And that could complicate messaging. Is that something you've had to deal with yet so far?
Yes. Yes, and I've got to think about this for a few seconds, because I think especially in the past 2 decades, we have become more global, and finding your niche for me is something different in the past 20 years compared to before, because then the niche was typically also geographically limited. But with the internet, that's not a limitation anymore. So if, for example, you're selling to, let's name something, right? You're selling to music producers that are very much into electronic music and thus are using very specific synthesizers.
Mm-hmm.
The needs that they have and the problems that you can solve for them, or, you know, the emotional things that they want to achieve, will probably be the same for everyone all over the world. But that is a very specific niche. So the messaging to them will probably be exactly the same. However, if we're looking at food, for example, it starts to be completely different.
Yeah.
Because if I'm selling to someone in Italy and I want to sell them a pizza, or I'm selling a pizza to someone in Mexico, for example, the messaging should be completely different. And there, I think it's such a commodity almost, that with the commodities, you're trying to sell to everyone. Which makes it then harder to do not have the geographical limitations. In all honesty, if I would pick something to start, I would always go niche, because the riches are in the niches.
Well, you read my mind, and I'm just imagining a conversation you're having with a founder, you know, at least in the beginning stages, you know, I don't know that it's keeping it simple.
Yes.
By consequence, being in a niche, whether it's geography or the vertical, I agree, it's been my experience as well. You got enough things to do, keep it simple.
Yes.
Don't overcomplicate it.
Focus, simple, one niche at a time, and then once you really figure out the niche, then you can expand into adjacent niches. That's what I would say.
Do you have a yardstick that you use to help founders decide when it's okay to expand?
Yes, if you know how big your market is, which is always still a combination of art and science. But if you know where there's a tipping point, and typically it's you know, if you in your niche are dominating 10% of the market, you can start looking into adjacent niches. Or from a negative perspective, if you see that your sales are being limited because you have to change your prices, or you have to add, you have to stack more value in your offer to still get a deal closed, that also typically means that it's time to differentiate into different target groups or different niches.
Makes good sense. I want you to be a futurist for me for a moment, or maybe it's already happening, but so obviously AI front and center. From my accounting and finance perspective, I'd say we're in the first, second inning. So right in the beginning, I still think a lot of agentic AI is still immature. Maybe less so co-pilots. How has it impacted your world, and what's your and what are you anticipating is going to look like a year, 5 years, 10 years from now?
Interesting question. And I can't say I'm not thinking about the, you know, this whole situation every day. So first, looking at how it's impacting my work or our work today already, I think it is completely changing the playbook of getting new products to market now already, because it's even faster. And especially in analyzing big amounts of data, gathering big amount of data in especially desk research type of situations, and getting prototypes out super quickly. However, if you're trying to scale a trashy value proposition, or if you're trying to get a trashy value proposition to market, it's also accelerating the trashy part. So having proper conversations with potential customers is still key, because that's, I don't see AI taking over that. And one solution is always creating new problems. So AI is already creating new problems that need to be solved. And that's where you will find the new value proposition of the propositions of the future. Now, if I look at our day-to-day work, I think most of the analysis will be done with AI, agentic AI, or you know, something like that. I think if you find interesting information about you know, what should be a great new value proposition, it will be so much easier later on to back it up with quantitative data. But the qualitative data you will still need to do yourself, because that is the work that AI will, you know, the creative work that AI will not take over. And then building the financial business case and all that sort of stuff, I think that will be easier. Creating or thinking about a proper business model and you know, how you will emotionally involve potential customers in your offering, that will still be something that people will need to do.
You know, I was thinking about what I think I just heard you say over the weekend, is that the power of relationships will grow exponentially.
Yes.
Because you won't be able to grab as much alpha from analysis, or, you know, as much opportunity from analysis, but being able, and things will speed up. And so, yes, I mean, everywhere I look around me, things will get faster. They should cost less, but there's still opportunity will be where someone who can get people to buy, get people to see the vision. It'd be interesting to see whether or not there's more collaboration like joint.
I hope so, actually, but yeah.
I can see that taking place as well, where there's just more value in offering a more broad coordinated offering that hits more components, either of the vertical or maybe even horizontally as well, and hit parts of the chain. Yeah, it's a fun subject. It's one I'm sure, like you, I mean, I think about a lot, and you know, we've started making investments in AI agents ourselves. It's like we see it's coming. It's like, you know, why does an accounting and finance shop employing engineers? It's like relevant. Martin, a ton of great insights. Before we wrap up, you know, as you look back, it sounds like maybe you wouldn't have bought the marketing agency, or maybe you would because you learned a ton. But what would you do? What would you do different, or have done different?
What I think is I wouldn't have got an investor on board in at the first stage. I think it would have been very, very wise for us to prove initial traction with getting contracts of actual paying customers. And especially because we're in a sort of consultancy company, you do not need the investment. In retrospect, I would have done that different, and that would also probably have saved me the wrong acquisition. But that's in retrospect because, on the other hand, I've learned so much during the whole journey from the investor, also from buying the company and then, having to liquidate it, and that also propels me to, where I'm right now. So, yeah, that's what I would say right now. Probably in 5 years, it will be a completely different answer.
We'll have you back on when
Sure.
that comes. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, it depends on the business as to why you need to bring on outside capital. Consulting, given that the overhead costs are effectively zero, I
Yep.
agree. There should be a really good reason. Also, love to you know, give you an opportunity to give a shout out to anybody. Use this time to call out personally or professionally. Anyone who's had a material impact on you over the years.
Yeah, you asked me the question before as well, and I actually want to thank a few people that really have helped me getting somewhere, but I also want to answer it in a different way with just people that I like to read a lot, and people that I think really, changed how I look at the world from a professional thing. So let me first start with that. Because once I started to learn more about Charlie Munger, late Charlie Munger, he completely changed how I look and view the world, and especially how he works with mental models. That was a very, very big change for me. The Category Pirates, it's something new, but they write very, very interesting stuff about how to position yourself, how to be different instead of better. And that is really changing my view on creating value propositions, etc. And of course, I mean, the sort of founding fathers of lean startup and experimenting, Steve Blank and Eric Ries, you can't name them if you're in corporate innovation or in innovation. I really think they are the ones that really changed how this has been done. And then from a personal perspective, like people that I actually work with, it's a Dutch name, Dan Bemelmans. But he really helped me through the very deep moments in the career. For example, when I needed to liquidate the company, etc., and when we really needed to find the initial new paying customers. So really big shout out to him. Of course, my girlfriend, who's always there and who always supports me, and because they're there, and a good spouse is really important, I think, in this whole journey. Lastly, it's a bit cliche, but I really think all the customers that really put their trust into our hands. We're still very young people that get very, very big assignments that can really alter the course of their whole company. And without them, I wouldn't be anywhere, because they're the ones that make my case studies, make my testimonials that get me into new companies. So I would really, really thank them all.
Awesome. Well, shout out to all of them.
Thanks.
Another thing I was thinking about over the weekend is just the power of mentors.
Yes.
Whether it's in a book or face to face, I think they're underrated, like significantly underrated. And the amount of upside for having the wherewithal or courage or, you know, being humble enough to go ask someone what they think is so damn powerful. I don't know why more people don't do it. I really don't.
I highly recommend it. Yes.
Yeah.
And for every stage, you will probably find different mentors, but having these mentors is of tremendous value.
100% agreed. Martin, really appreciate your time. Before we wrap up, anything I didn't ask you that you wanna talk about?
Probably we can talk for hours, but I think for now we you've covered almost everything. So that's good, and I'm very much looking forward to more conversations, actually.
Likewise. And if there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
LinkedIn. I would definitely go to LinkedIn. I try to post there at least one or two times a week. And you can go to my Substack, in which I share more long form content, in which I dive deeper on all sorts of topics related to innovation, startups, and investing.
Good stuff. All right. Well, we'll make sure to include that in the show notes. With that, Martin, again, really appreciate your time. Thank you. And for the benefit of our audience, Martin Van Kroonenberg, founder of BW Ventures.
Thanks a lot for having me, and see you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Martin. And again, thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO, founder of FinStrat Management. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.